Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And a special guest host this week, Meg Gulliford. Hi, Meg.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
We're delightful. Lauren is on a much needed vacation, and so we wish her very well. We can only imagine what she is drinking right now. What are you two ladies drinking?
So it was very exciting for me because normally I'm on the West Coast and this happens at some ungodly early hour and I'm drinking coffee. But today I had a plan to drink champagne cocktails and then I ran out of cherries and, you know, we have standards here. So I am instead drinking a lovely Chardonnay called Heroine, which I showed Meg and Erin has a corkscrew that says POW on it. So I'm ready for all of the action.
Man, there's a lot of Western New York going on in that sentence. I'm not even sure how all to process it.
Cheers from Rhonda.
Meg, what are you drinking?
I am in Somerville, Massachusetts. So I am...
God bless.
I know. At least it's not Medford. If I take 10 steps to my left, I am literally in Medford, physically. But in an ode to Somerville, I am starting with Bantam Cider's Wonderken Cider this morning. Or actually this afternoon.
I can imagine lots of ode to Somerville, and I don't think they involve niche cideries. I'm drinking coffee because I remain on the West Coast, but it is a cold brew Hawaiian vanilla Kona blend, and it was incredibly overpriced at the market down the street, which is basically like a place to gouge beach tourists. So I'm really living my best life.
That sounds like the West Coast.
Yeah, it's great. So as we said, Meg is our guest host for the full episode this week. There's a couple of important things to note about Meg. One, she's a PhD candidate at Tufts. It's very exciting. But much more importantly, she is a fellow Kansan. So you're going to have to put up with both of our weird-ass accents for the rest of this episode, and maybe we'll get Rod to have some green bean casserole when we're done.
Probably not.
We can totally do the Jell-O mold with something floating in it.
Oh my gosh.
Guys, I'm in Western New York. I'm familiar with adding Jell-O to things and seeming to think that is both dessert and salad. Very, very many questions.
I have no answers for you.
To be clear, we both hate that. There's really nothing to be done about it. But, you know, we like to start things on time. We've got there's a lot going on here. But before we get started on the rest of the Bombshell episode, let's ask Meg some Bombshell questions.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, in Lauren's absence, let me kick us off. What do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
I would say, because I'm a big sports fan, this is kind of hard for me because I kept coming back to sports, but...
Not a problem I have.
I know. I would say Hallmark movies.
Oh.
Especially during major holiday moments, like the 172 Days to Christmas, will there have a movie on every day? I tend to just watch them en masse after I'm done with a semester where I can fall asleep to them, and because they have a very predictable plot pattern, I can fall asleep during one, wake up in the middle of another, and know exactly what happened in the former two that I slept through.
If you could pitch a show to Netflix, what would it be?
Okay, like I said, everything comes back from sports. So it would be HBO's Hard Knocks, where they follow an NFL team, but for elite strippers.
Didn't see that coming.
No, it is part of the entertainment industry that most of us know only by stereotype. But honestly, what does it take to earn thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars each night? You know, these women, if you're looking at female strippers, because I think men's strippers are weird.
Weird. So weird. Except for Channing Tatum. We'll
just a different market.
But these women are athletes in supreme condition. So what's your training plan? What's your diet? Are there specialized trainers, coaches? Is there a farm team? How do you get pulled up to, you know, the highest levels of the sport? Not sport, but just the industry. How does that work?
Man, I would watch the shit out of that. You've sold me, Meg.
Who is your fictional or literary hero?
That would be from Beverly Cleary fame, the great Ramona Quimby.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Like, she's amazing. She started as a secondary character in Henry Huggins and went on to star in 8 books. She kind of characterizes the phrase zero F's given, if I've ever thought of someone. She lives the carefree life that I, as a woman of color, could only dream of. You know, she's a complete pain in the ass, but somehow hasn't been subdued by adults or the world in general. So I can kind of rock with Ramona Quimby.
That's a fantastic answer. All right. Are you ready? You ready for the final question? What is your favorite algorithm?
This is my favorite algorithm, largely due to the fact that it's comedy for free every time. The whatever algorithm is used to match people on dating websites, because I don't know, I think they do it in a way that gives you comedy for free. Like the gentleman, when I did it like a couple years ago, when I was matched with someone who had a shovel over his shoulder and while smoking a cigarette in a photo. And all I could think was, Patrick, there are people who love me and would come find me. So it's things like that where I just, it's my favorite, but not for a good reason, but more just to bemoan what's wrong with life.
Well, all righty then. We'll dwell on that, or maybe not, for just a minute or two.
I feel like we learned some important things here about Meg, which is really the point of the questions.
Yes, indeed. Which is, of course, the intent of the bombshell questions. Well, that and to entertain the interviewers, but... Okay, so it's been a busy week around the world, and we're going to kick into keeping up foreign relations here, and... Our first topic is actually North Korea. But before we dig into North Korea, while I was going through some of the Twitter feeds of my usual North Korea suspects, there were a couple of other events that were a big deal this week. One of which was that there was apparently a Russian nuclear-powered cruise missile that maybe exploded by accident. And I'll be honest, I did not read up on this into detail. And obviously, it's a lot of speculation and whatnot. But I just think that we should, you know, acknowledge that one, we are in the phase of exquisite and bizarre. We're kind of back to the 60s on like weird ass shit that people are testing on the missile front these days. And two, testing a nuclear powered cruise missile is just sort of crazy pants, right? It's not a nuclear arm. There's not a nuclear warhead on it, but it is powered by a small nuclear powered system. And it turns out when that goes badly, lots of things go badly. So I just thought that was worthy of note.
It is doing the way most when much less will do.
Which is not really the Russian way, right? I mean, sort of like famously, we spent millions of dollars figuring out a pen that would write in space and the Soviets took a pencil. I don't know if that's true, but that seems consistent with my experience in the defense industrial complex. So, you know, whatever. But yeah, nuclear-powered cruise missiles, crazy pants. Meanwhile, North Korea. Had you guys been paying attention to North Korea the last couple of weeks?
I loosely was aware things were happening, and then I started reading things today, and I was like, oh, this is not great.
And it's like way more things have been happening than I realized. So it's also only been 2 weeks since our last episode, but I probably worked 100 hours in those 2 weeks, it seems like. So I both missed a lot. But other people were also working 100 hours, because like there is just a lot going on here. So let me see if I can give us like a useful recap, and then we can discuss. So about 10 days ago, the North Koreans tested a new large caliber multiple launch guided rocket system, which we thought was a new ballistic missile, but in fact was not. And so that's this new system they tested 10 days ago. And then a little less than a week ago, so maybe 5 or 6 days ago, we're recording on Sunday, so August 4th or 5th, the North Koreans tested a short-range ballistic missile, the KN-23. This is a relatively new system. They first tested it in May of 2019, but it's not an ICBM. It's a short-range missile, but it is solid-fueled, and that is important for reasons we can get into. Then there was an exchange of letters between Kim Jong-un and President Trump on Friday, because meanwhile, all this is occurring, there are active military exercises going on between South Korea and the United States. So as always, we're dealing with a lot of stuff here. They test on Tuesday. Kim sends a letter on Friday. On Saturday, President Trump is like, eh, it's all good. Like, he sent me this really nice note. He's not going to do anything major. We don't really mind. And then they test a brand new missile system, their third new system deployed since Hanoi. It is fairly capable and looks like a U.S. ATACM system, which, of course, the nerds on Twitter are calling ATACKIMS, which works much better in print than it does on the radio, I have to say. But again, it's another solid-fueled, short-range system. So we've had multiple tests, three different systems tested in the last 2 weeks or so, and then kind of a weird amount of like diplomatic cover all going on while we are doing military exercise with the South Koreans. What did I miss?
The only thing I would add is that the president seemed to both be taking the North Korean side on the view of these exercises.
Oh, right. How did I forget?
And suggesting while they were happening that they're useless and provocative, which is sort of, you know, not a thing we generally say about joint exercises with our allies. So,
right. So the Tuesday tests earlier this week were definitely by the North Koreans were meant to say this is deliberately trying to delay, postpone, upset these exercises. And when that didn't happen, there were additional tests then this Saturday. So, yeah.
Any expectations for future tests for a fourth system?
I mean, so this is what's sort of interesting. As I was doing research for this episode, I was going through Twitter feeds from friends of the show, Vipin Narang and Ankit Panda. And I think both of them sort of were coming to the conclusion that, like, while the North Koreans have been dithering with us on quote unquote nuclear freezes or, you know, restrictions on the nuclear weapons program, they've been investing very heavily in an assortment of missile technologies. And these particular technologies, both the MLRS system and these two short-range ballistic missile systems, are basically designed for regional confrontations, right? So they're not meant to hit the United States. They are in range of U.S. allies, South Korea, and Japan. They're also designed to thwart U.S. Or other allied missile defense systems like the THAAD system, which is deployed in South Korea. And so they, whether they have their eyes on the prize is one question, but they are definitely engaged in significant activity to bolster their regional advantages or create regional advantages. And whether they do more tests is an interesting question in terms of like, is there more technical development? One thing that Ankit pointed out that I thought was pretty interesting is that Kim has continued to praise the science and technology community that has developed these new systems, as opposed to praising the military leaders who would be deploying them or who would be operating them. And that's like a weird, like, Kremlinology sort of thing in terms of, you know, to read, but did strike me as kind of interesting. So, I don't know if you guys have seen anything. I mean, the question remains sort of where does that leave U.S. policy and diplomatic positioning? I don't know.
Right. So I think from my vantage, there are two questions, which are one, where does that leave the U.S. with respect to South Korea and generally sort of our, you know, North Korea, South Korea alliance / containment maximum pressure approach? And I don't know. I kind of lost the plot on what the even argument for the Trump strategy could be if we were going to like ex post justify a strategy. So like I have a bucket of questions there. I also have a bucket of questions on whether this indicates a direction that we should be looking at for other alliances and other ways he talks. You know, the president has been on again about NATO and that NATO not playing its share and the EU not paying its share of NATO, which is a confusing other problem, which we can deal with later.
Details.
But, you know, if the president is going to sort of pick up, you know, we already know he has an affinity for some of these strongmen. If he's going to pick up some of the rhetoric on problems with joint exercises and key elements of these alliances, you know, there's a lot of follow-on effects from that in East Asia, in Europe, and Eastern Europe in particular. And so I think we want to kind of look in both directions, both on the broader East Asia strategy and on the what do we see on alliances and their decline perspective.
Well, it also doesn't pin the president into any sort of, well, you were right, you know, Kim has gone back on what we said we were going to do, because he's not testing nuclear weapons. So this could be well within, this is what a state does. This is what a state leader wants to have for his state, where Trump can stay out of criticism because he's not violating anything nuclear-wise in this case. However, what he is demonstrating is a lot of capability that should concern our allies in that region. Whether or not we have the diplomatic presence, which I don't believe we do, especially with someone like, you know, Huntsman's leaving, and even though that's he has connections to China, even though he's in, you know, he was in Russia or is about to leave Russia, the idea that we don't have people in place to even do the diplomacy at that level right now in any of our allied states in that area is problematic right now.
I mean, the other thing that I would say is that it's really plausible that this current president does not care very much if South Korea and Japan are at risk from North Korean missiles. I don't think he's literally losing a lot of sleep at night over that. And probably, in fact, is like, see, I told you we should just like bug out because we don't want to have to like put up with that. So, you know, the ways that most of us think about, you know, the alliance structure and the security obligations and that decoupling is bad. Actually, it's like a big impact turn. I think the president would be like, that sounds great. How do I make that go faster? And you're seeing him at least pour a little bit of kerosene on that fire. I think this week is certainly a bizarre set of engagements. But I think, you know, Radha, to your point, or Meg, to your point, I think we will see further tests. And I think, you know, Kim is probably being fairly strategic on exactly what kinds of systems, what kinds of technologies can be deployed, can be tested, you know, that will cause problems for South Korea or Japan, but won't per se upend this very careful dance he's doing with President Trump. So more to follow. Meanwhile, in South Asia, we've had some pretty sporty diplomatic developments and also military deployments in the Indian state formerly known as Kashmir, now merely a federal territory. Meg, you want to help us understand, bring us up to speed on what's going on there?
Absolutely. To provide everybody with just a little bit of background on this, even though y'all have talked about it, on August 5th, India's interior minister told Parliament of the central government's plan to revoke the special status for Indian-controlled Kashmir by scrapping two constitutional provisions known as Articles 370 and 35A. 370 allows the state of Jammu and Kashmir, which are in Indian-controlled Kashmir, to make its own laws and allow it autonomy in all areas except for defense, communications, and foreign policy, whereas 35A allows J&K, which is what Jammu and Kashmir are known as, the right to determine its permanent residence and gives only those residents the right to own property. This also will split J&K into two union territories, and so it will no longer be the autonomous state that it's been since British India decolonization, and it will now be governed directly by the main state. Jammu and Kashmir will have its own legislature, whereas a new union territory, Ladakh, I believe it is, will be ruled directly by the central government and have no legislature of its own. But more importantly, this is something we could have seen happening, really, because Modi's MJP, Hindu National Party, they performed really well in the May elections and campaigned heavily on revoking this J&K special status.
Oh, interesting. I definitely had missed that. Well, I knew they won, but I didn't realize this was so central to their party platform.
Absolutely. They argued that the special status actually hindered integration with the rest of India and referenced the need for more legislative effectiveness in the area, given the central government's perspective that J&K had been lagging developmentally behind the rest of India. And Modi's even gone so far as to couch it in terms of national security, right? But Hindu nationalists have opposed this special status since the 1950s. So what's going on now is that the Indian central government has deployed about 35,000 troops across the Kashmir Valley because they're anticipating a backlash of the revoke. They've done things like halted an annual Hindu pilgrimage, evacuated tourists, put everything into lockdown status. So they've banned movements and imposed public curfews. They shut down schools and colleges, put people under house arrest, and suspended phone and internet services. The opposition to this is actually far outside of India as well. So the current J&K leaders view the situation as an Indian occupation, right? and opposition politicians in India decried the move as pretty much attack on Indian democracy. They're looking at it as a very authoritarian move. And now you have Pakistan, who has Pakistani-controlled parts of Kashmir, standing in allegiance with the Indian Kashmiris, you know, and are having protests of support. For them, they find this very prejudicial of Muslims because JNK is actually India's only Muslim majority area.
Right. Like, that's the important context here, or one of the many important pieces of context here.
Pakistan is kind of like in a tough spot because the U.S., India doesn't see, isn't interested in coming to the table, and like, they're kind of like, possession is 9/10 of the law here. They have army, they've had military forces sent in, and Pakistan's both economy and international position are not such that they can get the support they need to really push back as strongly as they'd like. I think most recently, the thing I saw was even some of the Muslim countries like UAE were saying, hey, look, this is an internal matter, like, we're not going to get involved, which means that Pakistan, which has historically at least relied on support from other Muslim countries and saying that this was sort of disputed territory and not Indian territorial control, doesn't have that. I think the one other piece of context I'd add is, you know, way back in the day, my understanding is these territories agreed to remain in India at partition under the condition of autonomy. That's why those constitutional provisions existed, right? And so the removal of this autonomy is actually pretty meaningful in thinking about what dispute means for those and governance means for those territories. Sorry, Aaron, you're going to say something?
Well, I was going to say the Maharaja agreed to those conditions. It wasn't like it was put to a plebiscite in 1947 or anything. But I think, you know, we're already seeing some of this backlash that Meg has described. This weekend is Eid, which is a very significant Muslim holiday. There were Friday prayers, and there was a series of peaceful protests on Friday afternoon, which were met by fairly confrontational tactics from the police, not yet the army, right? So it's sort of emboldening the local police. And of course, we've talked a little bit about, there have been some protests in Kashmir growing over the last year or so. And as we mentioned, Pakistani army has also supported various separatist groups, you know, of the more, much more violent variety over the last few years. So there's a lot of kindling to work with here. And what's really interesting, I mean, I guess, you know, to me is, you know, it seems like this is something that's being done for purely domestic political reasons by Modi, the Indian prime minister, in support of his Hindu nationalist both party and an ideology. But like, what does it get them? Like, what is the net gain that they get out of this? Because it seems like just kicking a hornet's nest. And that's probably my ignorance of South Asia and the politics both within India and between India and Pakistan. But it did not seem to me that the thing that either of those two countries or the region needed was increased flashpoints in Jammu and Kashmir this week.
That's the last thing they needed. Interestingly, you know, of course, that's the last thing they needed. But right now, the size of the victory that BJP achieved in May emboldened them to do things like this.
Interesting.
Because they believe they're in a stronger position right now than they have been in a really long time.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there's the ideological part from the BJP. I also think India probably rightly assessed that Pakistan didn't have the resources or international support to push back in a way that they might if, say, a year from now they had done enough cooperation with the U.S. on these Afghanistan talks and they got off some lists and they're caught, right? Like, you know, they don't, right now, Pakistan doesn't have a ton of friends and they don't have a lot of people coming to complain about India. And I think between that and the ideological sort of views of the BJP and the views that these states should be part of India and governed by the Hindu majority, you know, they took the chance while they could. So I think it'll be something to watch as we see what this kind of occupation and response might be and if Pakistan really takes it to the UN Security Council and so on.
Well, Radha, this goes into a little bit about what you're going to talk about later, but Pakistan has downgraded their diplomatic relations and suspended bilateral trade with India.
Ooh, that's sporty. We'll definitely keep an eye on this. And I think we'll also probably see some speculation about what, not just the meeting between Trump and Modi, Trump, Modi, or Trump and the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan played into this, but also Was there an assessment that the U.S. would also not weigh into this? And did that give India feel like they had a free hand here? We shall see. But sticking with our Asia theme for this segment, we're going to move on to Hong Kong, which is in week 10, week 11 of really significant protests.
We're in our 10th weekend of protests, and it's really, you know, the extradition legislation that the Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, who has both a mayoral and gubernatorial role that she announced in March, has really, really come under fire. It's really about critics saying that it curtails the city's independence and free speech. And they're very much worried about it being a pro-Beijing policy that serves as evidence of mainland China's influence over the city, because now you can, the would allow mainland China to extradite people in Hong Kong to face criminal charges. That is something that has been not done and was not supposed to be done, just given the way these two were set up and the relationship between the two. The U.S. has weighed in on this as a national security and economic issue, but she pushed it forward. You had these huge demonstrations that were continuing to grow in size, but have become violent at this point. You saw the subway videos and things like that of people just getting beat.
Yeah, we talked about that last week, right? The white t-shirts and the white masks. Yeah,
absolutely. And then you have the idea of Lam characterizing these as riots, which has major implications for protesters because of the laws in Hong Kong. If you are caught rioting, you face up to 10 years in prison.
Right. So I think what's interesting to me is one sort of evolution of protest tactics. Like, I always love when people are like, the protests became violent. Did they, or were they met with violence? Like, those are sort of different pieces. And I think both of those things are happening here. The police, it seems to me, have certainly been, if not emboldened, provided clear direction to confront protesters. And we saw, I think this weekend, tear gas into subway stations, which you don't usually deploy tear gas indoors. That's a bad idea. It seems not great.
What started with protesters throwing bricks and, you know, trash cans turned into them on the receiving end of tear gas, rubber bullets, and batons. And so it's only gotten worse and more severe and, as I said, indiscriminate. But a lot of this, you know, Lam has come and said, hey, the bill's dead. We're not going to do this anymore. But she's yet to formally withdraw it.
Right.
So they have these five demands and none of them have been met. None of them have met in full. And so in addition to the lack of movement on those, you have some of the angst, the general angst in the population, given just the high cost of living and the economy in Hong Kong. You know, I think it was a couple of months ago, a 120 square foot nano apartment sold for $250,000.
Oh my gosh. That's like smaller than most American cars. Was there also a general strike this week? I mean, one of the things that's interesting when you look at protests and how protests turn into social movements, right, is both expanding the number of people participating, but also expanding the number of opportunities or points of participation across society. So moving from just large gatherings to other forms of confrontation. And so it seemed like, right, were there subway workers who were striking? There were maybe general airports.
Yeah, it wasn't just in one place. And they estimate that it was about 300,000 people striking across different sectors. You did have subway workers. And you also had a march in silence. So that happened to protest the Justice Department's political persecution. So people are using different types of resistance. So you have violent resistance and you do have the nonviolent civil resistance that some would say might work better. But at this point, comparing these to the color revolutions, but there's the comparison, which is off for so many reasons, but is actually appropriate for others. So
yeah, there was a good Monkey Cage post about this, I think.
Yeah. And so we're kind of in Hong Kong, what you're seeing is both sides of it, where you have very strident acts of violence taking place, but people who are marching in silence in non-protest, in non-violent fashion to protest So they're running the gamut, and there doesn't seem to be a unified core.
What also is interesting to me is that unlike the color revolutions, this is about restoring a status quo ante, right? This is not about overthrowing an authoritarian regime for people who have never participated in democracy. This is for, hey, we have a 1991 basic law. Why aren't we getting our rights as guaranteed under it? And that to me is an interesting piece. Radha, I don't know if you saw that there was actions against Cathay Pacific by the government in Beijing. There were Cathay employees who were participating in the protests, and Beijing said, we will terminate your landing rights if you don't police your people, which again gets to this very interesting, you know, sort of economics, politics, and private sector business, how all of those things interrelate in this particular region. So I think we said last time that we'd get some folks on to talk about this. I have to imagine that Beijing is incredibly concerned about the overall trend of these protests, the specifics of the demand. It's very interesting to me how quiet the U.S. has been. I would sort of love to know what's being said in the region and how we're trying to handle this. But there's, you know, I don't think you'd want to necessarily say there's a potential for a second Tiananmen, but the Beijing government is not going to tolerate this indefinitely. So I'm kind of on tenterhooks to see where this ends up going longer term. So speaking of trade, shall we shift gears here? What are we aghast about this week, Radha?
So regular listeners of this show, I should just say I felt really like in my heart that I really learned economics back in the day when I predicted that China had other tools to respond to tariffs and that their most likely one was current changes in currency value. Like we talked about the upcoming rounds of tariffs. So I really felt like all those years in school really paid off for one insight that many other economists also made. But look, even a blind squirrel finds nuts. So.
Were you also thrilled when the president said that the Fed controls the strong dollar?
Yeah. So who taught this man about quantitative easing and those words? I don't know. I never thought I would see them in Trump tweets. So just to catch everyone up, the Chinese currency, which is technically the renminbi, but it's denominated in yuan, so we're just going to call it yuan, weakened against the dollar. There's this seven to one benchmark point that's not totally arbitrary, but is one that has been used since about 2013. And the currency rose above that, meaning that the yuan was weaker than the dollar and thus made Chinese exports to the US a little bit cheaper and US imports into China a little more expensive. For folks, just to know, the Chinese currency isn't like a free-floating currency that adjusts based on markets. It's managed by the People's Bank of China, People's Republic Bank of China. And so the Chinese government actually sets rates in it, and it can buy and sell in particular U.S. treasuries to adjust its value with respect to the dollar. So the currency weakened. The U.S. labeled it.
God, I'm glad we have you here, Radha, because otherwise I'd have to learn and understand this myself, and that would be terrible for everyone, especially me.
Well, so the U.S. basically labeled China manipulator, which is not really, doesn't really mean anything, both because A, it's not really true. I'll come back to that. But B, like the penalties of it are like China could be excluded from procurement. We might be allowed to legally levy tariffs against them. So, you know, like, cool.
That cat's already out of the bag.
Right. And they might be subject to rigorous IMF monitoring. Again, great.
You guys can't see her facial expressions right now, but she's definitely like, and?
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 So what is actually new is, one, you know, China actually hasn't been manipulating its currency mostly since 2013. There's been a lot of sort of diplomatic and ongoing sort of market pressures to try to get China to have its currency be much more of a market-based currency and value. A lot of people think actually in this case, with the economic costs from the tariffs and weakening in the industrial sector more generally, that it made sense for the Chinese currency to devalue, and it probably caught up to its closer to its true market valuation. So it's like the opposite of currency manipulation. So it's just basically the Chinese central bank was actually normalizing its currency. It finally had to allow it to devalue. It also, China doesn't meet all these sort of technical criteria for currency manipulator. So the IMF report didn't sort of hang with the treasury designation, which is also kind of like, it came out like 3 days after the designation. They just like couldn't wait to do it. But the most important thing is, it's not clear that like devaluing your currency is actually that useful for China in this context overall. So what it does do is counteract the effect of tariffs by making the exports essentially cheaper. But it also
which makes it essentially more attractive for American buyers. Correct. So otherwise we'd be paying this extra tax on Chinese goods.
Right.
But now basically you're getting like 15% off while still having to pay the tax. And so it's like same at the total end.
But it also, you know, increases inflation. So it increases prices in China, same sort of pressure, mm-hmm. right? So that's not great right now for China. It also creates incentives for people to move out of the Chinese currency into other stronger and more stable currencies, which is like, again, the opposite of what China wants. So more or less, the argument, the best case argument would be China did this to sort of respond to the tariffs because the tariffs are having an economic effect, which doesn't make it currency manipulation. And the thing that does make currency manipulation, which Aaron alluded to, is the president of the United States calling on the Federal Reserve Bank board to adjust the US dollar's value to compete with China and make our exports cheaper, which is basically like, I mean, we shouldn't generally be doing that. B, we actually just recently at the G20 re-signed this agreement that the larger economies sign that say that they're not going to engage in competitive devaluation. So it's like, we have actually agreed to not do this. C, it's very contrary to our general principles of actually separating these international relations issues and international economic policy, which China regularly kind of conflates and uses to sort of trade off as different tools. But in the US and sort of part of the liberal order is actually separating those under the theory that economic interdependence is a stabilizing force. So not great.
And D, it's really good for making yourself the reserve currency to not have political factors drive your currency valuation, which is one reason why things are still dollar denominated and not won denominated. Am I correct on that?
That's right. So in fact,
I'm an economist.
No, I All think, right. you know, one of the things we're really increasingly, we talked about this a little bit with the issue of sanctions and Iran and the Europeans figuring out non-dollar denominated ways to do trades with Iran. Now we're talking about it in the case of having uncertainty on dollar valuations and whether they could be driven by political pressures. All of these are things that create these sort of economic clubs where people trade with their friends rather than trade in a market interdependent set. And the sort of underlying principle of this economic interdependence is the more economic interdependent and markets we have, the more chances we have to create sort of a rising tide that can be used to counter other types of conflicts and build sort of general economic stability. The more we move to these sort of club and trade models where we have groups of people that trade together and are also friends and everyone else on the outside is subject to tariffs and penalties, the more we have, you know, a separation of both diplomatic relationships and economic ties that makes it a lot easier to impose penalties and impose sanctions and overreact because there's not really a counteracting force.
Well, I know we have a lot more we could discuss here, and it boggles my mind, but I think speaks to Radha's brilliance that she makes trade interesting to me. Because frankly, I think it's super not interesting, except for right now, it is like crazy pants interesting. So, I mean, it's been like a month since we talked about Huawei. There's other like trade practice and, you know, treaties that we're trying to negotiate right now, but we got to move on to White House mayhem. Because it's a little crazy over there.
When is it not crazy over there, though?
Well, to be fair, and that is an excellent point, Meg, I have to say. Some weeks are a little crazier than others. We, you know, we have a Secretary of Defense now, so that's nice. We even have a full-staff Deputy Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
So we got that going for us. Meanwhile, while the Department of Defense sort of kind of has its act together for a while, and Mark Esper has been on his own rainbow tour, going to say hi to allies and trying to reassure them, and that must be a kind of a thankless job at the moment, the intelligence community has had a bit of a week. So I think just after we recorded last time, Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, announced that he would step down but would stay in office through August 15th. Dude literally gave 2 days notice. He's a cabinet member. That strikes me as kind of weird. Sorry, 2 weeks notice. But that seems, you know, whatever.
That's what his contract said, Aaron.
Right. So that kind of opened up two questions. One, who would, of course, be the eventual nominee to be the Director of National Intelligence? And two, who would be the acting in the meantime? And so on the one hand, this is a really important position. It's the coordinator for all of the U.S. intelligence services. It was created after 9/11 to try to improve, you know, kind of interagency relations within the intelligence community. On the other hand, the DNI is not exactly the most powerful office in Washington. They don't really have statutory budget authority. They can't actually hire or fire any of the other intelligence community or agency heads. So it's both a big deal in that you don't want a total clown in that job, but it's not quite the same as hiring and firing at NSA or CIA or any of our other three-digit organizations, three-letter organizations.
So just the one caveat to that is they do do a lot of work on the actual personnel force management for the IC.
Yes.
And in a world in which that personnel structure is under attack regularly, this role actually plays a really important part in bolstering and sort of holding the line on the intelligence community workforce. So,
which interestingly enough goes back to what Neda was talking about last week with the changes that are needed in the intelligence community. This might stymie any progress that may have been made or any efforts that may be in progress to actually make the intelligence community's personnel fit its requirements.
Indeed. So Dan Coats announced that he's going to step down. And then President Trump indicates that he intended to nominate Representative John Ratcliffe to be his successor. Now, you might say, John Ratcliffe, I've never heard of him. And you would be in very good company, along with like the entire United States Senate. He is a representative from Texas who claimed to have had experience in counterterrorism based on work he did as a U.S. attorney. It turns out that wasn't super true. It also turns out, did you guys follow this, that the president thinks that it's more cost effective for the media to do his personnel vetting than to have the Office of Personnel Management do it? Oh my gosh. Good Lord. So basically we're like crowdsourcing
qualifications, you know, for cabinet level positions. Yeah, cool.
Which, I mean, given the alternative, might be okay. I'm not really sure. So that sort of trial balloon lasts just a couple days before Ratcliffe himself withdraws and says he doesn't want to be a distraction. And
but also, am I right in thinking that his audition for this role was questioning Mueller on why he didn't totally exonerate, yes, Trump, and that's how his name rose to the top, yes, of the pile? Okay, just wanted,
yeah,
to double,
exactly,
check that.
So he was certainly not a career professional. You know, who is a career professional was the serving deputy director of national intelligence, one Sue Gordon, who frankly is a superhero, should have a comic book, is an extraordinary American, 25-year career professional in the CIA before becoming the deputy director at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and then serving at DNI. For those, as you guys both mentioned, interested in IC personnel issues, I mean, she was at the forefront, yep, of trying to get more and better and agile thinking into the intelligence community. And she was just summarily both sort of overlooked, pushed to the side. There was some talk then that she would be named the acting director of national intelligence. That did not happen.
I think she's like required to be, right? Named acting?
Well, she was until she resigned.
Right. Because you should, right, have your,
so, yeah,
team.
You should have your team. And I guess there's a report out this weekend that Dan Coats himself interrupted a meeting and asked her to resign. And I do not fully understand what happened with that. I will be honest. Maybe we'll get more reporting on that in the next couple days. But all that said, Dan Coats is leaving. Sue Gordon has resigned. And we do have a new intended nominee for that post, the former director or the current director of the National Counterterrorism Center, Joe McGuire, retired Navy admiral, I believe.
Yep.
And seems like kind of an anodyne, safe choice, you know.
But wait, is he the nominee to be the nominee or he's the acting?
He has been named the acting, but has not been named the nominee for to become the DNI.
And we don't know who the acting deputy DNI would be, I think.
Oh, good heavens, no. What level of process do you think is going to generate that?
I just,
Rada,
like to keep track of who's who where in my,
yes,
mental org chart.
Okay, so that's all very inside baseball, classic Washington parlor games. Meanwhile, in the real world, we're living with just some horrific outbreaks of not just mass shootings, but what are very clearly white supremacist violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been rough.
You know, I think basically everyone who is around and looking around at all knows that there have been a series of mass shootings at the Garlic Festival in Gilroy, California, in El Paso, Dayton, Ohio. And it's just, you know, the death toll and terror has been horrific. There's a number of issues that one could talk about in the context of these mass shootings. I think for our purposes, a thing that is worth kind of digging in, and I'd be interested in both of your thoughts on, is this sort of question of, should we think about this as domestic terrorism? What is that bias? How much do we care what it's called? And just kind of to level set, basically where we are is domestic terrorism has a sort of statutory definition, but isn't really something that imbues much authorities. Like, there aren't special tactics one can use that are distinct, as distinct from international terrorism, where there are a whole bunch of military and intelligence authorities we leverage and funding sources we use. Typically, people who engage in these terrorist acts are charged with crimes like murder, or Timothy McVeigh was charged with weapons of mass destruction statutes or hate crime statutes, that sort of thing, not with terrorism. And so there's been this sort of discussion on whether, A, there should be a law against domestic terrorism and it should be a federal crime, and B, whether we should call these things domestic terrorism. I'm using air quotes, which is not that effective on a podcast. but, you know, and how much that matters. And I'll just, you know, take the opportunity to say, I think a lot of the debate has focused on this question of authorities and funding. And there is a special FBI investigation that relates to domestic terrorism. So there's some stuff there. A lot of the discussion has focused on that. I think there's been less discussion on, like, we do have things we do for international terrorism, and we could worry about sort of the extent to which the rhetoric from the president or other sources has been radicalizing people and how we should think about countering that. I will just note, to date, we have not been great at countering violent extremism with our own sort of messaging and media effort. So it's not clear to me if applying that in the case of domestic terrorism would be that effective, but we certainly have some tools and techniques that relate to terrorism that might apply here. So let me kick it over to you, Aaron and Meg.
So I think what the part of this that I'm most interested in, one, I've always thought that these were acts of terrorism. I thought Sandy Hook was an act of terrorism, and that was a debate that occurred in the community. I believe those are acts designed to terrify. These more recent shootings also clearly have political ideology attached to them. You're seeing references to the New Zealand shooter, to those manifestos. There is linking an organization still mostly in a lone wolf manner occurring online. And so to me, from just an analytical, as opposed from a law enforcement perspective, they clearly meet my definitions of terrorism. That said, the piece that's most interesting to me is this radicalization pathway, right? How does someone go from, you know, being interested in guns, or, you know, being, you know, having a set of kind of right-wing type views, and most of these recent acts of violence have been more attached to right-wing organizations or right-wing ideologies than left. But how do you go from having a particular set of views to all the way up to, what I need to do about that is to shoot a whole bunch of people, or maybe to shoot a whole bunch of brown people? And that strikes me as, I mean, we don't accept that as like a natural course of action anywhere else. We engage in all kinds of activity to break that up if we think that there is a jihadi ideology attached to that. We went to all kinds of lengths to break that up if we thought that there was mob behavior attached to that. So we actually have, you know, a number of law enforcement tools and the inclination to use them in certain instances. But I think we've seen that, you know, these organizations, while previously had been higher up in kind of FBI organizations or FBI priorities, I'm reminded of Jessica Stern's book, Terror in the Name of God, which has a whole section on lone wolf, kind of Eric Rudolph style anti-abortion violent activity in the 1990s. And this was something that the Bureau did take quite seriously. I think they still take it seriously, but there's less clear, you know, how they want to go about dealing with it. But I think, you know, societally, you know, outside law enforcement channels, how you deal with this kind of radicalization is pretty challenging. Radha, you note that our overseas efforts at this have not been successful. I would just hope that we could be marginally more effective working in our own country, where we understand some of the cultural nuances, than we are in, say, Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere. But it is a non-trivial problem. And, you know, we're going to have to continue to look not just at gun control, not just at federal terrorism regulations, but more broadly, how, you know, essentially these young men go from, you know, one, you know, relatively, you know, not safe path, but, you know, a normal existence to thinking that the answer to their problems is shooting a whole bunch of people.
But do you think we actually understand the nuances of our culture?
Well, that's a great question.
Because I don't think we do. And just to touch on some of the things you talked about, because I want to come back to that, because I think that's a really important point that I don't think we actually do as a country. With respect to domestic terrorism law, you know, like calling it domestic terrorism or not, I don't think the label from an enforcement perspective or, you know, judicial perspective matters unless you have a domestic terrorism federal law on the books. I think calling it domestic, calling what has happened domestic terrorism or not, is a good thing for families, and it allows you to orient the general public. But in terms of what can be done by the FBI, I think that it becomes, you know, where Timothy McVeigh, we will treat domestic terrorism, we will call it domestic terrorism when it's anti-government, as he was, but if it's anti brown person, black person, immigrant, whatever, that becomes a hate crime.
And that's a really interesting shift in some of these ideologies. I mean, or at least the manifestation of those ideologies, I think.
And that's how I differentiate somebody like McVeigh, you know, who's very much anti-government, from some of these other men who are anti-group. It's very much an exclusive, you know, it's they're part of an exclusive group and they don't want anybody else being part of that or being able to take that power. So I think part of this is the fact that we just look at these things differently because of who the target is. You can't be anti the Stars and Stripes, but you can be anti, you know, brown person, black person, even kid, right? Mm-hmm. As long as it's not against the government. But I think when it comes down to looking at the radicalization of it, aspect of it, we don't understand this. You know, we don't understand the cultural nuances here. So the fact that we try and do this elsewhere is even more confusing. But until we start really understanding some of this stuff, and I can't remember his name, he's a Princeton professor of African American studies who really laid out a very clear argument that we as a country haven't dealt with a lot of the problems that we have that stem from Reconstruction, Jim Crow laws, and other such things. And until we can do that, none of this is actually really going to matter because we're going to be in the same holding pattern in terms of how we think about things. And, well, what about, you know, when we talk about this, well, what about the 70 people who got shot in, you know, Chicago last week, where it becomes a deflection as opposed to actually attending to the problem and understanding that it's not mental health. It's not just these disaffected youth or disaffected men. There, we have a problem and we don't know how to name it quite yet, but we're not really trying. That's the problem, is we're not really trying because we refuse to acknowledge it as what it, you know, it is bigotry and hate at its core. And white supremacy is not something for a lot of people that exists in this country anymore.
So I think, you know, just to kind of round out the discussion, I think that's exactly right, that we have a sort of multi-pronged thing we need to deal with, which is one, to really understand the ideology, there's going to have to be a sort of reckoning on the history and the extent to which the history of the U.S. and the history of some of these white nationalist movements really ties into modern behavior. I do think, you know, there's a whole gun control debate to be had. I also think there's a discussion to be had about how these different groups intersect. So groups that are anti-immigrant and groups that are, you know, sort of historically anti-black, actually a number of the anti-women sort of incel groups and groups sort of targeting that sort of community. And so I think there is a lot of intersection points here that we don't fully understand and haven't spent the time to map out. And it does seem to me there's probably some value in taking some of the network and ideology and radicalization knowledge that we have such as it exists and actually trying to bear down and learn it here. And so it'll be interesting to see the extent to which this terrorism debate sort of reduces to the same old, like, oh, you don't call it terrorism when it's not a white person. Oh, you only call it terrorism when it's a brown person, which is a discussion that can be had and whether it actually goes to the, hey, do we have tactics and techniques that can be applied here? And so I guess that's something to watch in the coming weeks to see what happens with this, whether this debate persists, which often after these shootings, they die out, though this time maybe is different. And if it persists, kind of where we end up.
Imagine that. Imagine an analysis and deep expertise informing policy choices and policy options. We should be so lucky. All right, my ladies, pop culture, have you any?
My pop culture is sad, so I will go with it first, and then maybe we can have move to more positive. So I when we were kind of chatting and prepping about the show, I noted that the pop culture thing I had most noted was Toni Morrison's passing. So I think it's just worth noting, one, that her writing is beautiful and incredible and worth reading a number of books. I obviously, Beloved is a famous one. The Bluest Eyes is another. There are a number of great novels that are worth digging in. But also just reading about her life and how she carved out time to write, how she called out interviewers when their bias was so clearly showing, and sort of how she created a space, insisted on a space for herself, and sort of created a model, I think, that a lot of people, African-American women, but also sort of women of color more generally, can use and emulate to figure out how to make their way. And I think, you know, she led a great life, and it's just worth kind of taking a moment to remember that.
Yeah, I think she was so incredibly unique for so many reasons. And Aaron, I am not a lover of all fiction, most fiction, but as a Black woman reading her books, it was the first time that I felt heard and seen in literature, where even though those life experiences for her various characters were very different, there is something about Black women that unifies us in a way. And what I found very interesting, there's not a Black woman or woman of color who does not feel that way about her writing. I think the fact that she was quite intentional about the fact that she was writing for Black women, but that others were easily able to come along and learn. And she was unapologetic and quite definitive about the fact that this is for Black women. Sammy Schalk, a gender and women's studies professor at University of Wisconsin at Madison, caught some flack on Twitter for saying, hey, white women, this isn't about you. These books aren't about you. And they weren't. Morrison said that with her own mouth, that they were not. But the fact that so many people, whether they be men, women, you know, gender non-identifying, you know, people, human beings found something for themselves in those books. And just the number of people at so many different levels who've come out and spoken about her and her writing is a testament to who she was, not only as an author, but also as a human being.
I'm going to wait for Lauren to return to discuss my very detailed thoughts on the naval career of one Logan Eccles. Ugh. On Veronica Mars. Because they are many, but they pale in comparison to your deeply reflective memories of reading Toni Morrison.
Yeah, sorry. So.
One of the coolest things I found out just in this last week was Toni Morrison was not her name.
What?
Her first name's Chloe. It's her ex-husband's surname and a nickname that was, you know, given to her, I believe, in college, but her first name was actually Chloe.
Well, that is an excellent note to end on, ladies. Meg, thank you so much for joining us. This was fabulous. And we'll have the regular crew back together next time. All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Bye.